Accession number 22123, Rule 4.
Alan Maybury, Rule 4.
Yeah, so the idea was to then snap it or crack it as one would a whip, and this in theory is supposed to break the snake or the vertebrae of the snake just behind the head. And one of the guys who put himself forward quite gallantly to try this was an ex-gamekeeper in civilian life, and had come across many different snakes or snakes in the UK, so at least he was quite happy to have a go at handling them. The exercise or the demonstration of how to do it went in a flawless way, as one might expect. But when this character first got hold of the snake, I guess speed is of the essence, because he grabbed hold of it by the tail. It seemed to be quite fast to me, but the next thing that happened was that the snake had curled itself around the guy's arm and was looking at him straight in the face. Now what? So the second way to kill a snake, of course, is to hack its head off with a panga. And I don't think any of us really attempted to ever do that. I mean, generally snakes won't come anywhere near the individuals. I mean, they just move out of the way. The only time when you're liable to come across these sort of things may be if you stay in the same place more than a couple of nights, you might find them in your hammock or something like this when you go to get in it. So you have to be a little bit careful. But the other range of problems here with wildlife was the water buffalo, a creature that just seemed to be half crazed. They were either completely and absolutely docile, or if they saw you, they would give chase and they could really, really run. And quite a few people had some nasty scares with water buffalo. Elephants, never saw any elephant, but I know a colleague of mine was on a patrol where they thought they'd bumped into a bunch of Chinese, and promptly enraged an elephant by shooting it and not realizing what it was. And this was, I suppose, the adverse side of the jungle. Monkeys and stuff like that, they tended to keep out of the way. They could sense us coming either by smell or whatever. And it was only the Iban that I ever saw that could actually get anywhere near them to kill them. And other problems, I guess, was dysentery. Almost everybody would come down with dysentery. And the more ferocious type of dysentery was amoebic dysentery. That had started to cause the demise of Mike Calvert, the guy who set up the Malay Scouts. He was terribly, terribly ill with amoebic dysentery when they sent him back to the UK. And I'm not sure physically if he ever really recovered from that. It's a very, very debilitating and life-threatening form of dysentery. Cholera, of course, that could run amok. Other than the CTs, who I personally never came across, but we did come across a lot of the Aboriginal Malay, the Sikai. They tended to be reasonably friendly, but they could be got at by the CTs. And when the old Hearts and Minds campaign really kicked in about trying to bring the villages back into enclosures for the night, the Chinese had really got to them first to tell them that once they were in these compounds, we'd never let them out and we'd probably kill them all in there. So it took a lot of persuading to make friends with the Sikai. The SAS speciality was to actually live with them and have the medics take care of them. Our own medic in the patrol that I was always with, he was basically self-taught, but I mean he could do marvellous things, and he would help them. He was also quite good at languages and managed to learn their dialect fairly quickly. I always seem to be too tongue-tied, but just used to be too lazy, I think, and rely on Newcomb to do all the talking. But that was really that really worked quite well. And we did find that one of the problems of incursion or insertion into the jungle was time. Generally, that one went in through plantations and things like this into the jungle, which incidentally gave birth to another problem. I'm not sure why they used to do it, but the planters used to spray the rubber trees and the leaves with an arsenic compound. And quite a number of our guys and even one of our air bands went down with arsenic poisoning. Used to get into the system probably through the water or whatever. That was not very comfortable.
What was it? What were the symptoms of that?
Nausea, fainting, temperature going up. Rumour has it that a number of guys in the infantry regiments that were out there actually did succumb and died through arsenic poisoning. But it was all new to us at the time. We didn't realise what was going on. Yes, we going back to the insertion aspect. The SAS tried to develop what we used to call tree jumping, parachuting into the forest, and that was never very successful. There were a number of attempts. In fact, Johnny Cooper, our troop officer, he and a couple of others decided that rather than ordering the chaps to jump into the jungle, they ought to experiment and see if they could find a safe way of doing it. And Johnny Cooper did jump into the jungle and got himself hopelessly tangled up. I think he actually got tangled up with his static line when he left the aircraft. I think he broke his arm before he even hit the trees, and then got into a terrible mess. I never saw him again after he'd done this exercise. He was hospitalised for months and months and months. And in fact, there was quite a regimental hunt for him, because the other two officers that went with him, I think they were all right. But Cooper was left hanging upside down in a tree for too long. And I believe our troop sergeant Turnbull eventually found him with a small patrol. But he was in a very, very bad way. So yes, they did develop this method of going in, but it was always fraught with danger. I mean, the crown of the trees were often sort of 50, 80, 100 feet off the ground. So once you've been snarled up, you just had to have something else on your person, an abseil rope or tape, to get from there, from where you ended up, to the ground. And Murphy's Law would often apply, so I understand that you'd leave your parachute harness and be abseiling down, and then the whole lot would give way and you'd sort of end up in falling quite a few feet onto the deck. Not very good. I guess the rest of my time was fairly uneventful. All the time, during this period, the CO of the regiment was a guy called Sloan, Lieutenant Colonel Sloan. We called him Todd Sloan. And he was trying to put the SAS regiment onto a firm, good foundation. And he was getting rid of a lot of the Malay scouts like crazy. And I found at one stage I was asked to go and see him and John Woodhouse. And John Woodhouse, by this time, was beginning to develop a way of formally training the regiment properly and formally. And John had said to me, I remember interviewing you at the parachute depot. He said, but one thing that you never told me was that you were a national serviceman. And I said, that's right, you didn't ask, so I didn't tell. And he said, oh, you nearly cost me my commission. And only jokingly. But the serious point came in then from Sloan, who said that what he wanted to do was to strengthen up the regiment. I had the opportunity to sign on for a minimum of 3 years, or I would have to leave the regiment. And I really had decided a long, long time ago that I wasn't really going to spend the rest of my life in the services. So I declined the offer, and I said to Woodhouse afterwards that what was going to happen now, and he said, well, there was a number of us all in the same situation, and that we would almost certainly be posted to an infantry regiment. I didn't know, but stepping back to leaving or finishing initial training at Borden, I had actually been identified to go to the Durham Light Infantry. But of course I'd circumvented that by going into the parachute regiment, then SAS.
Now there were quite a number of us actually that were destined to leave the regiment at that time because of the fact that we would not sign on for a minimum of 3 years. And I remember the RSM had a quaint name, Puttock. I think we called him Buttock for obvious reasons, made certain representations to the CO to keep all the national servicemen on. And also the squadron sergeant major, Bob Bennett, was our squadron sergeant major. He made the same representations, but it was to no avail, and so our destiny was to actually leave the regiment. The irony was that within 6 months, due to the shortage of manpower there, they actually started to recruit back in national servicemen from infantry regiments in particular that were already stationed in Malaya, and to my knowledge they served the regiment quite well until the regiment actually packed up their bags and left Malaya to go elsewhere. So really I think that that summarizes my spell there with them. It occurs to me that there's a couple of things that I haven't mentioned en route. One was the fact that I had my particular job was a signaller, and I had been trained to regimental signal level during my initial time with the 21st SAS, the TA regiment, in the beginning. And this was fairly comprehensive. Although, when I look back on it now, I recognise it was a very simplistic form of working, certainly with regard to maintenance of wireless sets. It was all done on what I now call the Monte Carlo process. If this doesn't work, try this. And then you'd follow two streams. Does it work? Does it not work? And it usually constituted changing valves and various other little cards within the radio sets. As I recall it, we had three particular types of radio set. Type 88, as I recall, was for very short distances, usually used by, certainly in the infantry, for patrol use. Then there was a Type 31, which had a far bigger range. I confess I can't remember what their ranges were. Somewhat more complicated radio, and significantly heavier to carry about. And then I believe it was the Type 24, which could either be mounted on a Jeep or attached to a special frame which the luckless signaller would have to carry, but somebody else would then have to carry the batteries, because the Type 24 was about 30 to 40 pounds in weight. And it was my misfortune, if you like, to have to carry this around in Malaya, because the other two types of sets just were not capable of reaching anybody. And even with the Type 24s, it was a very hit and miss thing, because the forest and the hilly nature of where we were operating, it was very difficult to make decent radio communication with anybody. And in fact, I do remember scaling trees to try and get an aerial that would work. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And then I began to realise, of course, that the art of aerials or antenna was black magic itself. Some, you know, you could do exactly the same thing in a slightly different location, and just nothing would work. But so for long, long periods of time, the patrol would be completely cut off, which always a bit disconcerting if you can't cry to mother for help, if we had ever needed it. Luckily, we never did. The other problem which we encountered in Malaya was, of course, the absence of any decent maps, hardly any maps of any worth. Of course, all the normal communications strips were well mapped, but once you got into the jungle, nothing counted anymore. It was almost impossible to find out from observation, direct observation, where you were, again because of the forest. So one had to rely purely on compass work and starting from a known datum. And this was another reason, very often, for the slow, very, very slow progress that one made, not only because of the vegetation and the swamps and what have you, but making absolutely certain that you knew where you were. And certainly the principle, if one ever gained the high ground, you would never lose it. Instead of going from A to B by the most direct route, which possibly would have meant losing the high ground, one didn't. We just kept to the high ground and, if necessary, went round in a huge loop to get from A to B. And it was really here, although I could use a map and compass before I went into the services, I think it was during this period that it really honed my expertise, certainly in compass work. And the other thing which I'm not sure if I mentioned en route, was the length of patrols that we were doing at that time. The patrols, actually where you were cut off from anybody else, could be of either 1 or 2 week period. And we had to be completely self-sustaining for that time. Now, I know the regiment went on to develop ways of resupply and what have you, where they stayed in the jungle for 6-8 weeks at a time. But of course, when I was there, it was very much in its infancy. And there's a lot of talk about living off the land. And yes, there were certain aspects that one could live off the land there. I think I've already mentioned the Eban or Dayak trackers. I mean, they would think nothing of finding a nice young monkey and eating that, which we all thoroughly enjoyed. But those were very early days. So I believe that actually finishes what I have to say about Malaya. I confess at the time when I left, I was glad to have left the regiment because it was not in a very happy state. It was in its nadir. I've already spoken about the fact that there was a collision of minds between the originals and the Malay scouts, and us poor little guys in the middle. But they sorted themselves out, as is the way of the regiment, principally through John Woodhouse. And went on, as we all know, to much better things. The other aspect about the regiment, I think, which is not too clearly understood, and it's there to this day, although they their setup is such that they never really get to know each other as in a normal infantry or corps regiment would do. Because they're always acting in small packets. And they're very competitive, extremely competitive. So I guess it's like a typical family. They can, at times, fight like hell amongst themselves, but as somebody else comes in from the outside and tries to sort of get into the family, they get short thrift. So I really left, quite thankfully, because of the environmental conditions. The hot, humid environment was not for me. I didn't like that one little bit. And it was quite interesting, almost as soon as I left the place, all the problems I had with tinea and other fungal diseases just went. So it was quite clear that I wouldn't really have survived much longer there. And of course there were happy times to remember as well. The tiger beer, tiger hangovers, I suppose, not so happy. marvellous institution, Tiger. It was some industrialist that had set this up. You could get everything from balms to rub into the skin, hair oil, beer, all made by the same organisation. Probably all out of the same product as well. So I left the camp at Sungi Bizi, and together with the other chaps that were leaving, all of us incidentally destined to go to the Durhams, we went to Singapore to pick up the troop ship that they were coming through on. We got there early, so we had a few days leave, which was very nice. We also found that there were quite a few others that were going to join the Durhams. They were obviously severely under strength when they set sail, and they were picking up people as they came through. The King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, which had been in Korea, were also in Malaya, and I think a lot of their new guys had come out, and they'd got peeled off, probably much to their horror, and reposted to the Durhams. So there was quite a few of us that actually got on the boat, which, as I remember, was the Empire Trooper. Ghastly thing. Put me off of cruise holidays for life, that has.
And what was it so bad?
I mean, it was. I mean, all the decks were just open decks with all with bunks and of 3 or 4 levels high, and in the tropics, of course, with inadequate ventilation, they stunk. And whenever we could, which was almost all the time, most people slept on deck and stayed on deck as long as they could. Now, I in particular joined the signal platoon and was quite well received because they were also very much under strength as a platoon, and got ourselves integrated with them. Quite a good bunch of guys. The signals officer was a guy called Tonkinson, Captain Tonkinson, and the sergeant was Sam Mason. And I must have caused him a few headaches. I remember on one occasion when we were doing some arms drill, because the whole time on the troop ship, they had to create work for people to do, otherwise it would have been intense boredom. And we either divided our time up into signalling exercises, maintaining wireless sets, etc., 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 and signals practice, which actually stood us in very good stead later on. And then, of course, remembering that we were going to a state of war, it was a question of arms drill as well. So on this particular occasion, we were invited to have a race to strip a brain gun and put it back together again, and then to do it blindfolded. And this was all going very well, and I remember Sam Mason saying that we were all far too slow, so we challenged him to a competition. And so he got the best guy from the signals platoon and himself, and it was quite clear he was going to win. He was excellent at it. And so I thought I would just slowly ease myself across, and with my foot I deftly flicked the breech block away from him. But unfortunately, it went into the scuppers and out through a hole in the side of the ship and disappeared. And so it left him scrabbling around on the deck, because it all came to and everybody was killing themselves with laughter. And I wondered how on earth he was going to handle that. He did it extremely well. He didn't report me, and because I owned up to it. Couldn't everybody else take the rap for that? How he covered up having a brain gun short of a breech block, I know not. But I found myself on intense cookhouse duties. I had been volunteered to do this for quite some considerable time. And that's where I ran into another little anecdote, if you don't mind my coming up with it. Down in the galleys, this was in the sort of bowels of the boat, of course, decided to have a look around the rest of the ship that was basically the crew's quarters, which was normally off limits for the service personnel. And we wandered through and we found a couple of us that were doing it. We found ourselves in an open mess cabin, I suppose, for the crew. And there was a ferocious fight going on in there. And it was really, everything was going. And one of the guys actually got an axe out of the firefighting equipment and threw it at the guy he was fighting with. Luckily enough, missed completely, but they had a parrot in the on the deck, and it hit the parrot. Completely killed the parrot, and the guy who had the intended victim looked at the parrot and pronounced it, you know, and then proceeded to count it out as in a boxing match. This actually drew the sting out of everything, and everybody, us included, ended up in fits of laughter all over the place. But I just wonder what would have happened if this accident actually hit the guy and not the parrot. where he would have been counted out. Anyway, that tended to be the routine. We got into Hong Kong, had a rather a good couple of days in Hong Kong. I'd got a school friend who had gone on to join the Hong Kong police, and I met up with him. He was just a junior officer, and in fact I met up with him on the way back as well, and he took me and my friends all the way around the good places to go in Hong Kong. We sampled them, but we went into the Wan Chai brothel areas and all that, and extremely colourful, I must admit. And then he took us up to the...